have, and Adobe Acrobat PDF Reader. I think that's the vulnerable one that my son wants to avoid. So give me some words on it, Eric. Go ahead.
No, let's put it this way. If you want to be absolutely nuts, don't hook your damn thing up to the internet. If you're not that nutty, then, you know, you don't worry about it too much. If you've got a good firewall, then coming into the house, then you have even less to worry about. But, you know, there are vulnerabilities, but, you know, you might not ever want to cross the street because you could get hit by a bus, but I'm willing to bet that you're going to cross the street.
What Java version should I have in order to be up to date, Eric? Go ahead.
Oh, I'd have to look up the number. I think my last update was like 2 days ago. It comes regularly. That may in fact not be your problem, but I suspect it is.
And one other crazy question, because you're one of these guys that's a lot more computer savvy than I am. Assuming that my son refuses to put on Acrobat PDF Reader for security reasons, is there any workaround that you know of, or am I stuck? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, well, because you guys are so nutty over there, what I would recommend is that you go pick up yourself a cheap computer, or an iPad, or a Samsung pad for like $50, and use that for reading things that are in the world that your son doesn't want to have anything to do with. Vulnerabilities in Acrobat is pretty rare. Acrobat is designed in such a way that there's no back doors, so to speak, to get to the rest of your computer. Basically, it's just a file reader, and it doesn't have, well, yeah, it does have executables if you turn it on, but you can turn them off.
Okay, I thank you for that information, Eric. Maybe I'll eventually be able to solve this one. So, John, I know you're having quite a bit of trouble with shipping those files. I thank you for the effort, though. KD2IXD. K2IW. Go ahead, John.
As far as that goes, Dick, thank you, first of all, for giving me the time. As far as that goes, I'm going to get you two copies of the files if I have to inscribe them on stone tablets and set carrier pigeons with them. You know, you're going to get them one way or the other. My question is, I'm running cable in the house from where the antenna comes in, goes into the lightning arrestor, and then goes from there to where my equipment is going to be. And you know, I think you may remember I'm using Belden 9913, which is a pretty high diameter cable. I need to secure that to the wall, inside a wall, maybe to the studs or something. Let me drop it. And I want to secure it in such a manner that it doesn't interfere with the signals passing through it. The only thing I can think of that's big enough to, you know, go over the 9913 is just regular electrical staples. But maybe you know, or somebody knows something better I could use. I got about a 25 to 30 foot run from where the antenna wire comes into the house to where my equipment is going to be.
Got information from Dick.
Yeah, Eric has recently done a lot of renovating of his house. I'm guessing that Eric has got a solution, and it looks like John's got a solution. KC2WGB first. Go right ahead, John. K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, John, I can recommend, they do make, you can pick them up at your, even Home Depot has it, electrical supply store. They have tie wraps that have a little hole in them that's used for mounting the tie wrap to a stud or whatever you want to mount it to, and then you can pull it tight on the cable. They work very well. They won't injure the cable. stable in any way, and you can adjust the tension on those as tight as you want. And they're very cheap, and they work extremely well. Back to you, Dick. KWGB.
Now, there's a warning about using tie wraps in coax.
Yeah, I'm going to pick up Eric in a minute. You said there's a hole in the tie wrap. You didn't complete the picture, John. There's a nail go through that hole, so the nail goes into the stud. The nail is holding the tie wrap, and the tie wrap wraps around the cable. And maybe, I guess, a super conservative guy will either wrap some tape or rubber or whatever under the tie wrap to make double darn sure that the tie wrap doesn't dig into the cable. If it was polyethylene cable, I wouldn't worry. If it's foam-filled cable, and you supply continuous tension to it or continuous pressure to it, the foam does slowly collapse, and you could get a little bit of grief there. So, John first, KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, it has a little eyelet where you would place a screw or a nail. You can nail that to the stud. And you don't have to worry because you can adjust the tension. You just snug it up. It works perfect. Will not damage the cable or squeeze it or anything. Very well. And you could use the white ones indoor. And you don't have to worry about ultraviolet. And they are tenacious. And you will, you know, just install them and forget it.
I don't agree with John.
Yeah, I can tell. So, Erica, I guess you're worried about foam-filled cable. Any kind of continuous pressure of a tie wrap could slowly deform the foam cable. Is that what you're concerned about, Eric? KE2EJ, after the beeps, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Now, if you look at a tie wrap, and you have a tie wrap that has a screw mountable, you look at a tie wrap that you normally see in the top where you stick the end of the tie wrap through, well, on top of that is a little more plastic and a round hole that holds it. My problem with tie wraps and coax, and it really doesn't matter whether it's polyethylene or foam, you wind up making impedance discontinuities, especially when you use a tie wrap tool, which actually snips the end of it off because it decreases a certain amount of pressure. I've run into situations where we've actually had to put a TDR on some long runs where they're held by tie wraps and found, you know, where the impedance discontinuity is great. It actually squishes your cable. You can use it and be careful about it and not have a problem, but people have a tendency to make it tight. And over time, the actual plastic, especially with heat, you would think that it would expand itself, but it shrinks. So that's where the problem comes in. But I use them all over the place, and if you're just careful about how you put them on, you don't have a problem.
Because you've squeezed the cable a little bit in a particular location with a tie wrap, and even if you've done this with periodicity, in other words, every three studs, so to speak, you've got a tie wrap. For the average amateur application, the amount of impedance perturbation, by my standards, is extremely small. The amount of squeezing you'd have to do, the number of wavelengths of which you've got to do the squeezing in order to make a substantial difference in the transmissivity of a cable. You've got to really work at it. Now, your standards are a lot higher, Eric, because you're using cables that have to have very broad bandwidth, very little group delay distortion, and so on. So when you ran into tie wrap problems, was it because of your broadcast standards? And as a ham radio operator, would that really have stopped your operation? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Alright, yeah, I'm fussy, and actually I found more problems with digital video running through coax, and by the way, the semiconductor is generally foam of a form, and interestingly enough, we're running 1.16 gigabits through it, which actually, if you want to take it down to megahertz, it's about 270 megahertz, if you want to think of it as RF frequency. And there we run into lots of problems because it's digital. RF, not so much. You do get reflections, you do get weird things that sometimes are hard to explain. And I've even seen it in RG8. But as a ham, who cares? You know, it's not a big deal. But for my standards of the things that I do, it does actually become a problem. And the funny thing is, you put the thing together and come back 6 months later, then the problems begin to show up, not when you put it on.
What happens after 6 months? Does the cable start deforming because of continuous pressure of the tie wrap? Are you, Eric?
That's one of the problems. And a lot of these cables which have foil shields, the shields crack.
If a person still wanted to use the tie wrap, because it's the best thing he can think of, can you think of a way in which you wrap some tape around the cable in the place where the tie wrap's going to go, put a small piece of rubber, sponge, or whatever? Can you think of ways of, if you want to be super careful, like you are in broadcast, where you can protect the cable, put some kind of an intermediate substance between the tie wrap and the cable? Can you think of a way that would alleviate your particular problem? And in your particular problem, tie wrap is the best thing you had. Did you find an alternative? KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, K2RIW, the tech man.
Well, we've tried a lot of different things, but the best ultimate solution is you get a tie wrap tool, and you can actually set the number of entrances in which you tighten up the tie wrap with, and it actually cuts the end of it off for you. That's where a lot of people run into trouble. They snug it up just nice, and then when they go with the pair of cutters, they just kind of put the cutters in there and give it a little bit of a twist, and that's usually when you get too much pressure, and they cut the top off. So I could see putting, you know, maybe some thick, double sticky foam tape, which gives you enough of a cushion that the sticky foam tape is going to take up the pressure because you're going around it and it's evenly distributed. But I've seen people put tie wraps on, whereas they pull it as hard as they can before they cut it, and that's where they get into trouble. But you know, us hands for receiving and transmitting, it really doesn't seem to bother us that much. But I have seen places where they've actually yanked on RG8 enough that it caused enough of a discontinuity that they wind up with the reflected signals coming back at the transmitter.
And once again, an awful lot of that is broadcast standard, where you need very low reflectivity, very low group delay distortion, very low periodicity of discontinuities in the cable, and so on. We amateurs have nowhere near that much persnicketiness, nowhere near that high a requirement for the integrity of the Z0 of the cable. The best example I can think of is that there are people who will study a UHF connector, a fully mated UHF connector, center conductor diameter versus outer conductor diameter, means that it's around a 35-ohm impedance connector when fully mated, and it's 3/4 of an inch or almost an inch long. Even at 432, an inch long length of 35-ohm cable in the middle of a 50-ohm cable, you study what's really going on. It's an extremely minor perturbation. There are people who think when they replace each UHF connector on their Mirage amplifier, that's going to pick up a half a dB of increased increased signal strength. Absolutely not. And when it comes to the articles I've written on UHF connectors, which you can read in the two locations, mic number one and mic number two. Mic number one's location is www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And you go to the right place of that mic website, you'll find not only the past 10 years of recording of the TechNet, but you'll also see copies of the K2RIW articles explaining what happens inside of a UHF connector, which is a big perturbation. I mean, for me to squeeze with a tie wrap, the amount I'd have to squeeze a cable in order to make the same amount of perturbation of a UHF connector in the middle of the cable would be huge. And the UHF connector does essentially nothing. Let me drop. You can also get a copy of those articles by going to Mike Number Two's website, which is limarktechnet.com. www.limarktechnet.com. L-I-M-A-R-C. Technet.com. And there you'll see copies of the articles where you can read both technical details about directional couplers and how to make them work better and how they work. And also this article on, there's about 10 articles there also, and one of them is about a UHF connector. The UHF connector has been blamed for all kinds of things, that it's not a valid valid insult to that poor connector. Yes, the connector is not weatherproofed, and yes, without other means of holding the outer nut, it could vibration work itself loose. So, as an outdoor connector without the protection of other weatherproofing techniques, it's less than an ideal connector. But it's expense is it's sedan cheap. It's sedan physically rugged. When you install the cable correctly, there's also an article in there as to how to properly put on the type UHF connector on the end of the cable. In my opinion, you must tin the braid first before installing the connector. There's a huge reason for doing that, and the article will explain that to you. So, tie wrap squeezing your cable, I think is I think it's a lot more smoke than fire here, if you know what I mean. I wouldn't worry about it that much. But there's ways you can be super safe and protected with foam rubber underneath the tie wraps on the cable if you want to be belt and suspenders there, John. KD2 IXP.
Comment.
Okay, John, go ahead with your comment.
KD2 WGB. Well, if you're worried about tie wrapping and maybe you don't know how to do it, you'll pull it too tight. I don't usually use a tool. I usually pull them up until they're snug. But there's something even better. They make sticky backs. Many companies make Panduit makes it, Exo makes them. They're about an inch square, and you can either use the sticky back or you can put a screw in them, mount it to the stud. There is a lap lock, they call it. It's a little snap ring that you just put the cable in, and it holds cables like a 50-pair telecom wire, or RG8 will fit under it. It'll apply no pressure at all to it, but it holds it in place. So if you're going to align them with studs or something, works perfect. You don't have to worry about any compression. KC2WGB.
Very fine, John. You called it sticky back. That may be a slang in the industry. What is the thing really called? What does it look like? Is it sold at Home Depot and Lowe's? What does it cost? Brand name? Give us a few more words. What does this thing look like? It sounds to me like it is some kind of a circular clip. You put the cable in, close the
square.
Okay. Eric said it's square. So it's a square clip that you somehow close it with the cable inside. And
there's a clip.
All right, it's got a clip. And sticky back, does it mean you peel some paper off the back in order to stick it to the...
Precisely, it's double sticky tape.
Okay, Eric, you describe it to us. Eric, what does it cost? Is it just called sticky back? Where do I buy it? What does it cost? What brand name? Give us some words on this thing. Try to mentally describe this thing, because I'm not sure I've ever seen one. K-E-2-E-J, K-2-I-W.
Yeah, there's a couple of kinds. A couple of types. Sorry, John, it doesn't run you. You can buy them at Home Depot and Lowe's. The best ones are made by Betts and P&R. The ones they sell at Home Depot, and okay, they're not that bad. After a couple of years, they tend to lose their glue. The Betts are made with the 3M stuff, which I haven't ever seen one of them let loose. It's maybe about a 1-inch square, a 2-inch square. There's different kinds. There's kinds where you actually loop your tie wrap through it and it holds it. There are other kinds that have a little circular piece of plastic that comes around and it's got little teeth in it. And when you slide it through, it grabs it on the teeth and you can't make them ultra tight, but they don't come apart. So you can have like a loop and the thing won't come apart. It'll always hold it without putting any pressure on the cable.
Yes, and Thomas Betts is the best. I mean, they do make excellent products, and they have no problem with that.
Roughly how expensive are these things, if either one of you guys know?
It's very cheap.
For a man who's got so much money in his pockets that sometimes it's dribbling out, to him is cheap. So, John, looks like you got a couple of solutions there. KD2IXP, and whenever you select a solution and start installing it, come back and let us know how it worked out for you, John. KD2IXP, K2IW, the TechNet.
Thank you, gentlemen. You've actually answered the question. I'm looking at the Thomas Betts sticky square right now on my Kindle, and I appreciate your help. Thank you, Dick. Thank you, John. Thank you very much, Eric. And Dick, I hope you feel better. You sound like you got a terrible, terrible thing. Take care. Stay warm. 73 KD2 IXB.
Not really. I don't think I've got a cold, but maybe I should change this microphone. One of my microphones. Let's see, what is it? Looking for the model number on the microphone. By the way, if you hear noises in the background that you think should not be there, please report them to LIMOG by listening on the input. When you listen on the input, you hear what amplitude is the signal you're listening to that shouldn't be there. Go to LIMOG.org, and there's a way that you can report the signal strength. They're really looking for signal strength reports as to what you hear when. So if you hear something you think shouldn't be there, please help out LIMOG and report it to them. Okay, the next person on our list was KG2 Romeo Yankee. Go right ahead, sir. K2LAW in the TechNet.
I have a question about...
By the way, Dick, he's in the West Village and his name is David.
Comet.
comet rotatable, and he wants to know about the length of the elements, if anybody has any information on that.
Okay, I'll repeat what you just said, John. KCQWGB, KQRIW. KC2WGB, K2RIW, KG2RY, Comet, C as in Charlie, H as in Hotel, V as in Victor, number 5, and the elements, 6 meters to 40 meters, rotatable trap dipole.
You copy that, Dick, right?
Roger, Dodger, got it very well. So Comet, CHB5, Comet antenna. You want to know the length of the elements. Is it all the elements or only the 6 meter elements? Which of the elements you were looking for the length of, David? KG2RY, KG2RIW? Half inch, I think you're in the ballpark, well inside the ballpark, but capacity. What's your QTH right now?
QTH, I'm northbound on 70, 71 in Ohio between Cincinnati and Columbus, and the road conditions are horrible. They had a snowstorm come through here earlier. The visibility is good, but road conditions are real bad. Yeah, you're right. You're not going to see that in the ad, but certainly online. I don't know if he has the antenna, doesn't have the manual, but I can almost guarantee you, you can find the whole assembly manual with all the dimensions you're looking for online. It's more than one location, most likely.
Okay, now that we're hearing David rather well, David, repros your question if we haven't given you a partial answer so far. KG2, Romeo Yankee, K2RIW, go ahead, David.
K2RIW, KG2RY, thank you very much. What I'm saying, I have the antenna. The antenna is constructed. All the elements are assembled to the proper length, to whatever frequencies they're meant to be resonating. The question is, like, if I use an antenna tuner, if I use an antenna tuner, would that extend also the range of resonant frequencies, and would I be able to cover the bands if the resonant frequency is close to the center of each band? Go ahead.
And you're asking a good question, David. Glad you did, because interesting concept here that a lot of people misunderstand. Let's assume now that I've got a multi-band trap dipole that's made to work from 80 to 6 meters. Each one of the individual sections is centered on each one of those bands. The 80-meter section is centered on 8750, and the 40-meter section is centered on 7150, and so on. And the 6-meter section is centered on 50.5. I'm just picking numbers out of the air. And now you want to tune your rig outside of that center frequency region. Even though it's a multi-element trap dipole, and the particular section that is now resonating for you is, I'm picking a number now. Let's assume that the 6-meter section is on, it is maximized for 50.5, and you want to transmit on 51.5. And therefore your antenna is going to be highly inductive. It's going to give you, let me pick a number, a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. If your antenna tuner has enough tuning range, and there's ways you can find that out, and now with your antenna tuner, you come to a good impedance match, would you get full radiated power? The answer is absolutely yes. As your standing wave ratio of the antenna becomes very high, the signal is now bouncing back and forth between you and the properly tuned, between the antenna and the properly tuned antenna tuner. The signal is bouncing back and forth between the two. And depending on the loss of your cable, you're going to get some extra loss of the cable. But for the signal that gets to the antenna by way of your antenna tuner, it's going to work like a charm. So even if it's a multi-band, multi-trap, dipole-like thing, let me drop. As long as that radiating system consisting of the antenna, the cable, the ballon, if there is one, the antenna, as long as that radiating system gets resonance, 90-some-odd% of your power will be radiated. So the antenna tuner doesn't care if the thing on the end of that cable is a very complicated multi-band antenna or a simple dipole or monopole. In either case, it will force that thing into resonance as long as your antenna tuner's got enough range. And there's even a working around if it doesn't have enough range I can tell you about. So that's going to work like a charm, Dave. You're a lot better off than you thought. KG2RY, I wonder if that's some of the information you're looking for. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KG2RY. Thank you very much. This antenna will go up in a few days, so we'll see. You know, when the weather gets a little bit warmer, I can get access to the tallest part of my building. At least the roof is the tallest part for me. It won't be the tallest part on the roof, and it won't be the tallest part in the near in the neighborhood. But hopefully, it'll put out a decent signal. KG2RY.
So as you install that, Dave, and antennas are not rocket science. They're not black magic. The way they're described in the books, the way they're described in the courses we can take from the good colleges, they would lead you to believe that an antenna is extreme black magic with a deep understanding of three-dimensional matrix equations of the Maxwell's equations are required before you get partial understanding. That's the way many of the courses that we take will lead a person to believe. And so there, well, I worked for a company called Airborne Instruments Laboratory that in its heyday had over 1,000 engineers. The majority of them were electronic engineers, and an extremely small percentage of them didn't have a fear of antennas. 90-some-odd percent of all the antenna engineers, of all the electronic engineers, guys with everything from 0 to 30 years of experience, a high percentage of those guys were scared to death of antennas because of the very poor way the traditional teaching methods introduced them to the subject. They came to the conclusion that it's real black magic, very hard to understand. You talk to any good ham radio operator that has spent a couple of years, and maybe even only a couple of months, let me drop, of tweaking antennas in his backyard. And by very simple techniques, he found out what works and what doesn't work. And so he ends up with a list of mental rules of thumb of what you can do and what you can't do. There's a hell of a lot of things you think wouldn't work, and they work like a charm. The RF energy is blind as a bat. I mean, you take a look at the size, you take a look at that picture of those couple of clip leads sticking into a chunk of material. That was the very first transistor, the ugliest looking thing in the world, but it worked. Those electrons flowing through that ugly thing didn't know the difference. As long as the right circuitry is there, it worked. By the same token, you can make an extremely pretty looking, shiny, gold-plated antenna that if it's not assembled correctly, works very poorly, and you can have an antenna that's homely looking as all hell, but it resonates and gives a reasonable impedance match, and it'll work like a charm. There are guys that worry themselves sick because they got a great big bend in their dipole, a vertical bend like an inverted V or like a V or horizontal zigzag, and they assume that the RF is not going to go down there. It doesn't see those zigzags. You can get away with murder in a lot of these things. You find that out by experimenting in your backyard. You try to look that up in a book, you'll never find that information. Talk to a guy who's really done it. You want an antenna engineer, more than 50% of the time, you gotta hire a ham radio operator, because the schools are not turning out antenna engineering designers. They absolutely are not turning them out. There's a huge change in the way they teach that subject required, but they're locked into 60 years of tradition of the way they've taught it. Each of the professors only partially understand the subject. They're scared to death to change it. Therefore, they just keep turning the crank and teaching it. They think they're teaching it the same way. Let me drop. Of all the electronic engineers I have ever interviewed that were candidates for being hired at the couple of companies I've worked for, and whenever I've asked them, of all the courses you've taken in college, which course did you like the least? Which course gave you the most amount of trouble? More than half of them will say, that damn fields and waves course, that Maxwell's equation course. It gave me an awful lot of grief. It was a great big memorization of matrix equations. I didn't have the vaguest idea what was going on. As I may have told you guys once before, I met one single human being who loved that course. She was a female engineer working for Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and she was a math major. She loved the mathematics. Didn't have the vaguest idea what it meant or how to apply it. She just loved the mathematics. I met one person that liked the course. From her point of view, that wasn't an antenna course, if you know what I mean. So there's a big change required. And so by way of all of the hints we give you with the rules of thumb you've heard over the years on the technical net, there are people who have written me letters, college professors, telling me that there's more antenna engineering design being that information is being given out by the technical net. A number of professors have told their students, listen to the technical net to find out what real hands-on electrical engineering with RF circuits, what is it like? They were recognizing the fact that the curriculum that they were forced to follow in their particular college was not giving the students that information in a useful engineering form. That's a bunch of opinions. I've been saying that for a long time. It's going to take forever for that 60 years of tradition to finally wear down and for somebody to grab the bull by the horns and make a change in the way we teach that subject. Let me drop it. There are approximately 20 different wireless products that we, the American public, and the public in general, is using. All of those wireless products do not work without a good antenna. So antenna engineering, when it comes to RF circuitry, you could make a philosophy that the antenna is the most important part. The transmitter can be gold-plated, the receiver can be platinum-plated, you know, best possible design, and if you don't connect it to a working antenna, you've got nothing. So both on transmitting and receiving, the antennas are damn important. And therefore, that subject should be well covered in a useful engineering form in our universities. It is not. And the professors are extremely slow to come around and recognize that. Before you can solve a problem, you first have to admit you got a problem. They're not admitting there's a problem. They've been doing that way for X number of years, and their attitude is, why should I change now? Hey, John, I'm going to climb off my soapbox and tell us what kind of questions we've gotten at the mailbag this week. KC2WGB. Our mailbag, maybe. K2RW. Go ahead, John. And by the way, John, please mention the name of that crazy file for filing Bondo. I didn't write it down, and I didn't remember the name. So for people who are filing Bondo when they're doing sheet metal work on their automobile, there's a very fancy file you should know about. John's going to tell us the name of that file. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. It is a Vixen file. Vixen file. And it used to be very common, but a lot of people haven't heard about it. But very good to have, and you'll find it useful in a lot of things, by the way. Okay, now, we got a nice question from a young guy who is he's 14 years old. He's studying tube theory, and he's read about the grid leak resistor. He'd like to know if you could describe why it's used and what is the purpose of it, and give a quick rundown on that if you can. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
In the case of a vacuum tube transmitter, for instance, particularly one that's running Class C, as the RF drive signal is applied to the final amplifying tube, that voltage is usually big enough so that the control grid becomes a diode rectifier. So because of the diode rectifier function, in other words, as the you've got a coupling capacitor between the driving tube, exciting tube as it's sometimes called, and the final amplifying tube. There's a coupling capacitor in there. And because the positive peaks of the RF signal create grid current, that coupling capacitor ends up with a negative voltage on the grid side and a positive voltage on the driving tube side. So you develop a voltage across that coupling capacitor that, because of rectification at the control grid, when the control grid is more positive than the cathode, drives the control grid negative in average voltage. And so if there was nothing but that coupling capacitor, eventually the control grid would drive itself sufficiently far negative that 99% of the time the final tube amplifier would be in the non-conducting mode, the inactive mode. By putting a resistor from control grid to ground, you're now bleeding away some of that rectified voltage that's being accumulated on that coupling capacitor. Let me drop. And if you adjust that resistor to just the right number that's compatible with your drive signal amplitude and the mode in which you want to operate that final tube amplifier, as you adjust that resistor from control grid to ground, you're draining away some of that charge on the capacitor, and you might end up with an average voltage on that control grid of minus 25. And for the way you're using that tube, minus 25 volts of average voltage on the control grid might be using the tube exactly where you want to use it during Class C service, if you know what I mean. So that's one way that a grid bleeding resistor, as it's sometimes called, it's got all kinds of the names, but that resistor from control to the ground is draining away some of that current, some of that charge on that capacitor, setting the control grid bias to the right voltage for the operation of your tube, class B, class C, class AB1, and so on. The bias that you put on the control grid is the primary function that sets what mode that you use the tube. And so vacuum tubes still are in use today. There's a lot of darn good transmitters we can lay our hands on that work very nicely for very good prices with vacuum tubes. And the vacuum tubes are extremely important when it comes to microwave work, traveling wave tubes, klystrons, magnetrons, and so on. That microwave oven of yours has got a beautiful vacuum tube in there, that magnetron tube. Let me drop it. That magnetron tube that's in your microwave oven gives you a lot of bang for the dollar. My goodness. The very first microwave oven built by Percy Spencer at Raytheon Company way back in 1950-something? Yeah, around the 1950s. That very first microwave oven was almost the size of a refrigerator and cost something like $10,000. Here we are today. You can buy a very good a medium quality microwave oven for around $80, and that magnetron tube that's in there is turning out 750 watts of 2.45 gigahertz, 2450 megahertz magnetron tube. You can replace that tube in there probably for $30, 700 watts of output at 2450 megahertz for $30. Boy, you're getting a lot of bang for your dollar. So vacuum tubes are going to be with us for a long time to come. There are people who think everything should be solid state. I don't think we're going to see very many solid state microwave ovens anytime in the future, because for you to get more performance and more bang for the dollar out of that 700 watt output tube for a microwave oven, for you to do that solid state, I'm pretty sure it would cost you more and you'd get less reliability. That's an opinion. So vacuum tube circuits are worth studying, even though the whole world thinks they've gone solid state. KC2WGB, I wonder if that's close to what you think our questioner was asking, John. K2RIW, the TechNet. You got it, John.
Yes, Dick, I think that was a good answer. Also, is it possible that the grid leak resistor was also to maintain the grid in a attitude where it cannot go positive? Is that also part of that grid leak system?
It's the other way around. No. Let me think about that. If you use no resistor at all, every time the control grid goes a little bit positive, current will be drawn. You'll accumulate a charge on the coupling capacitor that's feeding the signal into that control grid. And so without a grid leak resistor, the tube will almost always bias itself in such a way that it's 99% off. That's not good. And by the way, grid leak resistors, usually used on a Class C final stage transmitter, but there are places where you can use it as a resistor and a receiver also. Your particular receiver, maybe a number of the tubes work best at a bias of, let me pick a number, minus 5 volts. So if somewhere in the receiver there's a power supply with a regulator giving you minus 5 volts, there's a minus 5 volt bus bar going down the center of the receiver. And if you've got a number of resistors coupled from each of those control grids of those tubes over to that minus 5 volt supply, the right value of the resistor would mean that the average voltage on each of those control grids would be minus 5 for reasonable signal levels going into each of those control grids. So it would be a beautiful way of setting proper bias on tubes. In many cases, you'd like some feedback in biasing. So in many cases, what a manufacturer does is he has a resistor on the control grid of the receiver tubes, for instance, and maybe even some of the tubes in the transmitter. Let me drop. He might have a resistor on a number of the control grids going straight to ground. That's a high-value resistor, 50 kilo-ohms or something like that. So it has no effect on the signal, but the presence of this 50 kilo-ohm resistor from control grid to ground means the control grid is being held at very close to 0 volts. And then you put a resistor in the cathode. And now, as the tube draws current, the resistor in the cathode, which might be a 100-ohm resistor, gives you a certain amount of voltage drop. And as that voltage drop the cathode start to becoming positive as far as the control grid to cathode voltage. If the cathode went up to plus 5 volts and the control grid is at ground, as far as the tube is concerned, it's operating with minus 5 volts on the control grid compared to the cathode. The advantage of using that cathode resistor is now the system has automatic feedback. If the tube draws too much current, you get a bigger voltage drop on the cathode becomes more positive, the bias on the tube is now more toward cutoff, and the current goes back down. So it's an automatic negative feedback. So very stable bias networks for tubes and transistors quite often will have a carefully selected resistor value from cathode to ground or from emitter to ground on a transistor. Quite often it's got a bypass capacitor on it, so the signal doesn't get attenuated by that resistor, but the average current flowing through that resistor sets the bias in a beautiful negative feedback manner that it's a kind of a servo mechanism that forces the tube of the transistor to be right in the operating region where you want it. So well done bias networks with a resistor from cathode to ground or emitter to ground works very well. And as even more elaborate networks, we have also got a feedback resistor from plate back to control grid. But bias networks, there's a whole art and science to designing very highly stabilized biasing.
Repeater, time out.
There's a whole art and science to designing very stable biasing networks for tubes and transistors. So if you find the right article, and you could probably Google that, biasing networks, feedback networks for bias and so on tubes and transistors. As I said, a lot of work has gone into that over the last 100 years, and not too complicated to understand it, to calculate it, and extremely effective with very little expense to the components. There was a huge contract a company I worked for had where they were transmitting very high frequency signals, 10 megabits per second of digital signals through a network that had to end up with a very high voltage that was designing, that was eventually driving a crystal modulator of some kind for a fiber optic, OC192 fiber optic standard, 10 megabits per second on this four-stage amplifier. And the Don engineer who worked on that project, I was called in as a consultant at the 11th hour. It was too late for me to save it. Let me drop it. They had chosen to use capacitive coupling between all the stages of this four-stage amplifier. That's taking a very fancy digital signal, very broadband, 10 gigabits per second, OC192 signal. And what the engineer didn't realize that, yes, the network signal, the signal that they had to amplify, by definition, had an average of zeros and ones that was exactly 50% in the long range time, 50% ones and 50% zeros. Therefore, the engineer naively used capacitive coupling. He completely forgot about the fact that occasionally a digital signal, a very high-speed digital signal, will have 50 ones in a row or 50 zeros in a row in the data, which means that the data goes positive for a long period of time or negative for a long period of time, and you build up a charge on the coupling capacitor. At the end of that sequence where there's 50 consecutive ones or 50 consecutive zeros, the accumulated charge on your coupling capacitors will drive the amplifier crazy. The next few bits to come through with a huge amount of distortion, and your eye, if your eye diagram closes up. So capacitive coupling on that kind of a network was absolutely not required. And they were the second vendor. The original vendor was using DC coupled circuits, and they had to have some extra transistors making sure the bias was set just right. And so I tried to convince these guys that, hey, the operating design, the one that's out there working right now, is DC coupling, but it's got 8 transistors. And you guys said, I can name the tune with 4 transistors, and you use capacitive coupling. And you got yourself into a hell of a lot of trouble by not studying the competing design. They went through all the grief of DC coupling. There's a reason they did that. And you just jumped over that and said, well, I can do it better. Well, they spent almost a year on that contract, and eventually...
Repeater, time out.
They spent a year trying to make that thing work. Couldn't figure out why the hell periodically it would close up its eye diagram. because the real signal generator that emulated this really crazy digital 10 megabits per second signal would occasionally put out 50 consecutive ones, and the circuit would be driven crazy for a while. It would take quite a while to recover until the capacitive charge on each of these coupling capacitors got bled away. And so they were carefully adjusting the supply voltage and the bias voltage on each one of the stages, looking for the magic level which would make the problem go away. There was no magic level. It had to be DC coupled. And they didn't want to hear that, and they eventually went into default on that contract. Lost an awful lot of money on that one. So capacitive coupling, it's got some magic and it's got some grief. And so properly biased and biasing transmitting amplifying stages in that environment, as I said, the simple looking schematic, but in some cases there's a hell of a lot more going on than you can see from that diagram. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Comment take it to you.
John, first, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Very good information, Dick. Yeah, I'm surprised at that. That would be something that you wouldn't think of, but yeah, that's very true. Well, I recommend to this gentleman, if he would pick up any of the well-written tube manuals made by Sylvania, GTE, RCA, a lot of that information is in there with load charts. He could have a ball with that, but it's good to see somebody's paying attention. I'll go ahead and pick up Rich, and then I'll pick up my next one. Back to you, Dick.
As I said, that company where I was called in as a consultant at the 11th hour, in which they had to start shipping something in spec, and they couldn't do it. And when I brought to their attention the fact that AC coupling couldn't possibly solve this problem, it had to be DC coupling, which would have been a significant design change for them to add the other transistors that control the biasing of each of these DC couple stages. They lost quite a few megabucks on not being able to deliver on that contract. They didn't get the profit of the delivery, and I think they had to pay a penalty for non-delivery, the way the contract was written, all because of this AC coupling that should never have been there. And that particular company had a history of coming out with brand new designs where they did not do a thorough design review. When you're committing a number of megabucks of your company's resources, better be doing a damn good design review. In other words, have a bunch of your smart engineers look over the proposed design to find out if there's any bugs in it. And the way they would do design review, they were so conscious about whether or not they're wasting man hours, they would present the raw data to all the reviewing engineers one day ahead of time, as opposed to a week ahead of time, didn't give the engineers enough time to study what the requirements were and what the offered the concept for delivering was. Let me drop. So the design review engineers were being given too little information, too late, weren't given enough time to really study the design, didn't have a thorough enough design review, therefore they didn't catch these bugs, and boy did they pay. It was very false economy. So when it comes to biasing networks and grid leak resistors, you worked on a number of transmitters in your time. I bet you've seen resistors that burn themselves out, and therefore the stage starts working very poorly. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, fine, Dick, N2EO. Yes, well, you know, tubes are still very much available. A lot of people don't know that. There's a company called Antique, but